a small part of his work, but a part that connects back with what we've seen in Plato and that looks ahead to what we'll see in later philosophers, and that's basically his idea of what's called metaphysics. Before I get into that, let me just remind you that the first assignment is now on the Avenue page, and it'll be due 2 weeks from last Monday, so a week after the Thanksgiving break. I'll be talking about Aristotle today, and then whatever's left over, I'll finish up when we meet after Thanksgiving, and then the following week we'll be starting with some later authors, still back in ancient Greece, but authors that were writing after Plato and Aristotle, and the first of those will be Epicurus. All this material is on the course outline and in the course path. Now, this work that we're reading now, Aristotle's treatise called The Metaphysics, begins with the famous statement. He says, all human beings desire by nature to know. Now, he gives an argument. We enjoy perception. We enjoy on, even when it's not useful. Watching a sunset, say, or looking at a colorful seashell. To Aristotle, that proves that we enjoy finding things out, acquiring knowledge. Knowledge by itself is a pleasure and a good. We don't have to always have an ulterior motive for investigating something beyond curiosity and the pleasure of its satisfaction. He says that the motive at the beginning of philosophy was this kind of curiosity, this wonder at things. That's what got the Ionians, like Anaximander and Xenophanes, that's what got them thinking about philosophy. The motive of those first philosophers, he says, was simply the desire to understand, the disinterested pleasure of comprehending the causes of things. We all desire to know. Philosophy begins with that desire, with wonder. Wonder at the very being of things, their presence. What are they, really? How did they come to be as they are? For Aristotle, human beings are unique in nature for having science and philosophy. We can understand the reasons of things. Other animals cannot. Animal cognition is limited to perception and memory. Animals have no experience, and Aristotle is using that word experience in a somewhat technical sense, but animals don't have experience. They have perception, memory, but no experience. Aristotle's word for experience is empiria, as in empirical. Animals don't have empirical knowledge. Experience is different from perception, because experience is the acquisition of beliefs. Animals have habits, like people do, but people also have beliefs, which no non-human animal does. Belief is not the same as perception. To perceive a tree is not yet to have a belief about the tree. You have a belief when you use your logos to judge that perception. To see a tree, to smell a flower, to touch a feather. Those are not yet beliefs. They become beliefs as soon as we think the tree is an elm, the flower is framed. Then we recognize our sensation with a name, we classify it under a concept, and impute to it a reality and truth. That is experience. The experience that is the foundation of all the rest of our empirical knowledge. Only a logical being, a rational being, has that kind of experience and the possibility of empirical knowledge. A belief has the element of conviction. We don't merely see the tree. We are convinced, whether rightly or wrongly, that it is a tree, that the tree is real, that it has a form and a property. Animals never have convictions like that. They don't have beliefs. All they have are their sensations and their habits. Well, that shows us that there are two kinds of processes, two quite distinct processes, that go under the one common name of learning, the first two items on my list of keywords. There's one kind of learning that goes from perception to habit. That's what your cat does when it learns about the sound of the can opener. Hear the sound, tasty things in the bowl. Hear the sound again, more tasty things in the bowl. It forms a connection, not really a belief, just that connection and a habit. So that's an animal association of particulars. Particular sound associated with particular smell and good feeling in the mouth and so on. But there's another kind of learning that passes from perceptions to beliefs. And that's the distinctively human form of learning, a rational cognition of those particulars. That is what Aristotle's singling out as experience, as empiria. Belief then differs from perceptions, it differs from habits. It also differs from knowledge. Aristotle follows Plato, what we were saying about Plato last time, and portrays belief and knowledge as completely different things that don't go together. Nothing believed is known, and nothing known is a belief or an opinion. Beliefs are going to be either true or false. True belief is a very low grade of cognition. It's not knowledge, but it's closer to knowledge than mere perception or animal habit. Aristotle interprets the whole spectrum of cognition in a metaphor that comes to him quite naturally given the kind of society that he lived in. It's not our kind of society, not organized the way ours is, but it was for him. And he used that social organization as a kind of an image for the range of knowledge. And that's what I've indicated with this diagram. Belief is the cognition that's appropriate or that belongs to the lowest, most humble grade of person in Aristotle's society, the manual laborers. Experience allows these laborers to do certain jobs effectively. They have some true beliefs about the material that they work with or the procedures, but they have no understanding of reasons, no scientific knowledge. We go a step up in the ladder of knowledge, and also, in Aristotle's view, a step up in the social hierarchy, if we go from the laborer to the master craftsman, the artisan who's in charge of, say, all the laborers in a workshop. This artisan or master craftsman goes beyond the cognition of particulars to the cognition of universes. And that means that they begin to think in terms of general concepts and logical reasons. They don't merely have experience of this or that particular thing. They appreciate the reasons for what they direct the laborers to do. Without the guidance of these reasoners, these master artisans, the laborers would be incapable of acting productively. This ascent continues to a next higher stage with the engineers and the architects. They're the masters of a kind of science, an applied productive science, but not pure theory. So we take the last step, the highest step in Aristotle's mind. When we ascend from the productive, applied, useful sciences to the pure sciences, which have no practical utility. Aristotle's world, of course, it's not ours. His assumptions are not automatically the same as ours. And to his mind, a pure theory that was just true, but completely useless, that's really good. It's way better than anything that's useful. Because if it's useful, that means you can use it to satisfy some need. And that means you must be a needy person, a limited person. A person who has certain demands and can only live if those demands are satisfied. To Aristotle, that means you've still got a foot in the animal world, but you've really broken out when you can enjoy pure contemplation just because it's true. without any concern about what you can do with it or how it can be advantageous to you. The Aristotle, that kind of useful thinking, means that you're still stuck in this partly animal kind of world. Belief is a low-grade intellectual reaction to the senses. Nobody believes that 2 and 2 make 4. You know it, or you don't. The senses never give us that kind of certainty. The senses never show us anything more than accidental connections. You open your eyes and turn your head and see a tree and it looks green. It looks higher than a house. Now, those may be true, but they're entirely accidental. They're incidental to the tree as an existing natural reality. You look, and you see, and you say, the tree is green. But it's not always green. It's not necessarily green. Just wait a little bit longer, and it will no longer be green. So, to Aristotle's way of thinking, you don't really know anything about the tree just from that sense experience. Knowledge, in the strict and philosophical sense, only begins when we understand how things are always, not just today, always. How they are necessarily, not just by accident when you happen to have inspected. Knowledge is impossible until we can judge that our perceptions are the same despite their changes. I see a tree today, and it's only as high as my knee, and it's green. I come back in 5 years, and it's brown. I come back in winter, and it's higher than my head. How do I know it's the same? For Aristotle, that's what knowledge allows you to do. It gives you what you need to be able to judge that it is the same, despite all those changes. What you have to know to be able to know that it's the same thing, despite various sensible changes, you have to know the essence. Knowledge begins when we grasp this essence, the principle of a thing's being or reality. The essence is the form. For instance, the form that organizes the material components of a tree and makes it to be a living thing. It's this form that's all, it's like Pythagoras. Wisdom for Aristotle, as for Plato, as indeed for all these philosophers, what is wisdom? The philosophers distinguish themselves from religious thinkers of the past. They distinguish themselves from poets by their understanding of what it is that they're loving when they love wisdom. They love reason, rational truth, intelligent, intellectual, cognition. Wisdom for the philosophers is the best and the highest kind of knowledge, the knowledge that's most worth having. That kind of knowledge, it's a science, but the question is, what is it a science of? Well, let's go back to Plato for just a moment. I'm talking now about Plato. He equates science and philosophy and wisdom. From his point of view, those are just three words for basically the same aspiration. He equates wisdom and philosophy, but distinguishes them from science. Sorry, I didn't mean to get confusing. It'll be Aristotle that equates them. Remember last time we talked about Plato's distinction between science and philosophy. Science, he said, is wrapped up in those hypotheses. Science is always hypothetical. It begins with hypotheses and draws out the implications, tests them, goes back and forms more hypotheses. And Plato said, that's fine, that's good, that's a kind of thinking, but we want more. We want to be able to discharge those hypotheses, to have a kind of thinking that goes beyond hypotheses. That's what he thought philosophy could do, and the dialectic was the method that was supposed to do that. And that was Plato's thinking. Aristotle is less concerned than Plato was to make a sharp distinction between science and philosophy. For Aristotle, philosophy, wisdom, that's just the best science, the culmination of science, the highest form of science. But again, we're still wondering, what is it a science of? Every science has its special subject matter. So what is wisdom, philosophy, a science of? Well, Aristotle, in the beginning of the reading that we have, gives us a kind of a profile of how he thinks of wisdom, or what philosophy is aspiring to do. Here are some of the main points when he says, what would wisdom be like? What are the characteristics of wisdom? Well, one thing is its generality. Wise knowledge is the most general kind of knowledge. It's knowledge that holds true of the most number of different things in the world. He also says it's going to be difficult knowledge. It's not going to be something easy to know. It's not going to be something that just anybody can master overnight or on a weekend, the way that just anybody can have sense perception. You open your eyes, you can see. Wisdom isn't going to be like that. It is, he thinks, also going to be a teachable kind of knowledge. You can learn it. In fact, he says it's exact and teachable knowledge of causes. It is too purely theoretical. In Aristotle's book, this is a good thing. Pure theory is way better than application. He's not impressed with utility. He doesn't think it's particularly good if you can go make something with your knowledge. So it's going to be purely theoretical, science in the highest degree, with no utility. It will also be the knowledge of a superior kind of person. He says, the wise person must give orders, not take them. The wise know the right thing to do. They know the ends for which all things are done. They know the purposes and the reasons for things. And finally, he says that this wisdom that we love as philosophers, that we are seeking, not that we have, but that we're seeking, it is a divine kind of knowledge. And it's divine in a double sense. So note this, two different ways, two senses in which this knowledge is divine. One is that it will be knowledge of divine things. We'll see this in more detail later today and next time. But one of the main things that Aristotle will be expecting from wisdom is he will learn about the nature of the divine entity, or the divine part of nature, of the world. So it's divine, and this divine knowledge in the sense that it's knowledge about divine beings, but it's also divine because it's the kind of knowledge that those divine beings have. It's the kind of knowledge that a god enjoys. So that's the profile of wisdom. But it still doesn't tell us that simple question. What is this knowledge of? He's laying out the picture of this kind of super science, metaphysics, it would come to be called. He didn't use that term himself, but that's what the tradition will call this. What is it a science of? All of the sciences are sciences of one or another kind of being. Mathematics studies quantity, physics studies motion, biology studies organisms, and so on. They're all the sciences. So Aristotle now asks, could there be a universal science? A science of qualities that any entity of whatever kind would necessarily share with all other beings simply because it is? Because it is a being, because it has entity and reality. If there could be such a science, that would be knowledge of beings just insofar as they are beings, just insofar as they're in being. Aristotle calls that knowledge of being qua being. I know that sounds a little strange to you, that Latin word qua, but that's the way that the tradition always uses it, so I'm introducing you to that. Being qua being, that little qua, that means as. Being as being, being just insofar as it is, never mind the further qualifications. That's the objective of this ultimate science that he's projecting. That's what the wise know. And in the time ever since Aristotle, this has come to be called metaphysics. Well, since the time of Aristotle, more than 2,000 years ago, this science, or this would-be science, has been subject to a prodigious development. We'll see a great modern example of someone still trying to do what Aristotle was trying to do with this project of being qua being. We'll see a modern example of this when we get to Spinoza. More recently, philosophers have turned against metaphysics and come to question the possibility or the value of such a science, being qua being. We'll see examples of this kind of skepticism about metaphysics when we look at Hume, and then again when we look at Nietzsche. So Aristotle is proposing that there could be a science that studies what it is to be, period. Never mind all the further qualifications that distinguish numbers from places, from days, from substances, just to be. And so he's posing this question, what is it simply to be a being, being qua being? The very first thing he does, instead of answering that question directly, he criticizes Plato's answer. You remember that Plato's answer is, being means idea. To be is to be an idea. Being qua being, that's idea. Aristotle thinks this is a mistake. And he gives three arguments that he hopes or he believes to disqualify Plato's approach to this question. First thing he says is that these ideas that Plato invents, they don't really explain anything. Suppose I've got a particular apple, holding it in my hand, a particular sensible entity. I ask that philosophical question, what is most truly in being about this apple? Not the color, because that changes. Not the shape, because that could change too when it dries or as it grows. Not the fragrance, because it could be rotten, it could be fresh. So what's in being about this apple? Plato says, the idea of apple. Aristotle thinks, he says, how can that be an explanation? First I have this apple, and now I've got the apple and this other thing. Plato calls it an idea. I can't really hold it in my hand like the apple, but I've got two things. I've got an apple and an idea. And I'm told by Plato that that idea is what is truly in being about the apple. But how does the idea explain the apple? What's the connection? Here's a particular, here's an idea, what links them? What makes that idea explain the being of this apple? At a very minimum, what you'd think Plato would explain for us is how does that idea cause that? Does it generate the particular in some way? And if so, how? How would a world of sensible, particular, material bodies arise from those Platonic ideas, eternal, changeless, immaterial? Now that, you might think, yeah, that's a pretty obvious question, isn't it? If you're going to do what Plato does, that's a pretty obvious question. And you might think in your naivete that somewhere in those thousands of pages of Plato, there's the answer to this really good question. But there isn't. Plato never explains this. So Aristotle says that's a problem with that idea theory. A second argument of Aristotle's develops this criticism. His first point that I was just touching on is that Plato doesn't explain how ideas cause particulars. The second argument that Aristotle gives, the second criticism, is that his ideas can't explain motion and change. He You think about nature. Probably the most obvious fact about nature, the one thing that really is clearly going on in nature, is change. Where isn't nature changing? Where is there anything that is really not moving? It's just a question of scale. Your chairs may not seem to be moving right now, but just go down to the nanoscale. They're vibrating all over. Change, motion, the most obvious fact about nature. But those ideas of Plato's, they don't change. They don't move. They don't vibrate. They're timeless. They're changeless. They're immaterial. But the material particulars of nature never stop changing. So there's got to be some kind of a connection between a thing's changes and its idea. But ideas can't change. And that makes it very hard to understand how they can explain change. So there's Aristotle's second criticism of that theory of Plato's. And finally, this theory of Plato's, think about what Plato's saying. You look around you and you see particular things, they're colored, they're heavy or light, they have textures, odors, and so on. Plato's saying, that's not real. Sure, of course, you think it is, but you're just one of those slaves chained up in the cave looking at shadows. Don't trust those foolish opinions. Plato is saying the only thing that's really real in the world doesn't have a body, doesn't occupy space, it never changes, it's always the same, eternal, it can't be seen or grasped with the hand, the organism, but only understood intellectually. Now, Aristotle is sensitive, as you are, or indeed should be, to how that violates a kind of gut feeling about reality. How can something invisible and purely intellectual be more real, more substantial, more veritably present and in being than the horse that I'm riding, the water that I drink, the people that I interact with? So that's another reason to be dissatisfied with this idea of Plato's. It seems just too ethereal and unreal, and it violates our sense of what reality means. So Aristotle is going to try to do better. Well, to find his own answer to this question of metaphysics, being qua being, Aristotle takes a hint from language. Words like is, to be, these seem so simple. Think of how many times in a day you say a word like is, or one of the conjunctive forms of to be. The simplest words in our language. They seem simple, but in fact, he observes that their usage is actually quite complex. We're not always saying exactly the same thing every time we produce that little word is. One thing, only one thing, but one thing that we mean by is, when we say that something is we mean substance. To say a horse is, is to say a horse is a substance. It has a presence that we can sense. It has a nature that we can investigate. That's quite different from saying that a color is, white is. I can say a horse is, white is. I mean, it's not untrue. It may be a somewhat odd way to speak, but it's not untrue. Five is. To say that numbers are, they have being, is to say that they are the quantity of a substance. Five is means there are five horses, there are five trees. To say that white is to say that it's the color of a substance. But if there were no substances, then five wouldn't exist all by itself. White wouldn't exist all by itself. Five only exists as the quantity of substance. White only exists as a quality of substance. Not everything is like those substances. Not everything that is or that has being is a substance. There are lots of non-substantial beings. Now that sounds a little strange when you first hear it. Lots, there are lots of non-substantial beings. Qualities, quantities, places, durations. None of those have any being apart from relation to a substance. Substance is thus the underlying being, the ground being. It's the ultimate being, the foundation of reality. Now that's Aristotle's first conclusion in this effort to try to spell out what is being qua being. The primary meaning of to be, primary, not unique, not single, but the primary meaning of to be is to be a substance. What is it merely to be? There's no simple answer. There's no one answer. Being means different things, many things, but fundamentally, primarily, it means to be a substance. And everything else that there is, everything else that enjoys any being, if it's not a substance, then it enjoys that being only because it has some relation to a substance. It's the place where a substance is. It's the duration of a substance. It's the quality of a substance. And maybe the first couple of times you were willing to admit. But as I begin to drive it home, to distinguish it, it's not a quality, it's not a quantity, it's not a place, not a duration. And you might begin to be, sort of begin a little mystified. What exactly is substance? Now, the difficulty of this idea of substance is how simple it is. You think there has to be more to it, and you must have missed it. It's hard to understand that something could be so easy to understand. A substance is something that exists in itself and not in another. There's really very little more that I can say to explain that. You just have to think about it. A substance is something, anything, that exists simply because of what it is. It doesn't depend on something else. There is no external cause that makes it to be or to exist at all. White is not like that. Five is not like that. Only substances. The opposite of a substance is an accident. An accident is something that exists in another, that cannot exist in itself. So a horse, for example, that's a substance. It exists. It has a kind of autonomous reality. But the horse's color, the horse's weight, those only exist because the horse exists. They're accidents that exist in the substance. We pose this question, what is it to be? The answer, no one thing. The being of substances is different from the being of accidents. An actual being is different from a potential being. So there's a diversity of meaning for this inconspicuous word be or is. A diversity of meaning, but not a sheer diversity because there's a kind of order in that diversity. There's a complex meaning of being that is centered on the idea of substance. Everything that there is a substance, or it's related to a substance as an accident or a potential. We ask, what is being? No one thing, but substance is at the center. Then we ask, what is substance? I give you a formal definition, anything that is in itself and not in another. But still we want to ask, okay, but what is like that? What kinds of things are in themselves and not in another? Well, again, unfortunately, there's no one answer to that question. There are different substances, different sorts of substances. Substances can be material. They can also be immaterial. Substances can be perceptible. They can also be imperceptible. They can be composite, or they can be simple. So Aristotle finds this heterogeneity, but also will be finding a kind of unity amidst that heterogeneity. Question?
So a substance is a thing and an accident is a characteristic of that thing?
Yes. The ultimate substance, the one that organizes all the other types of substance, and that makes all the substances to be, is what Aristotle calls form. Now, when you hear this word form, in philosophy this word has a somewhat, especially in Aristotle's philosophy, somewhat technical specific meaning. When you hear this word form, you need to try to make an effort not to think only of shape. What form really means is organization. Form refers to how a thing is organized, how it's put together, the way that parts come together to make an organized whole, and how the thing tends to behave. So to know the form of a thing is to know how it's organized, how is it put together, how will it tend to behave, what's its usual tendency. Form is the one thing that has to stay the same for a substance to endure despite the many changes in its axioms. The form, understood in this technical way, organization, tendency to behave, that form will be the essence of the substance. Now, I'm aware that our language is getting metaphysical and the terms are starting to proliferate. Essence comes from a word that simply means being. The essence of a substance is the being, or what it is about the substance that's most real and causes it to be. Water, there's a substance. What is its form? What is its essence? Now, we could think about qualities that water has, liquidity, transparency, but you can see that those can't be the form, those can't be the essence, because water shares both of those qualities, liquidity and transparency. Gasoline is like that. Alcohol is like that. Even if we could construct some unique, invariable quality that's present if and only if water is present, that still wouldn't give us the essence of water. And the reason it wouldn't give us the essence is because we wouldn't yet understand. We just had this quality that was always there. Quality that was always there. We wouldn't yet understand why water has precisely those qualities without one of them. That's what we need to know the essence. The essence of a substance explains all its other qualities. The essence of water, that's H2O. It's because water has that molecular structure that it has all its other qualities. Now, of course, Aristotle didn't know about that. But if he knew what we knew about chemistry, he would agree at once and say, yeah, that's exactly what I'm trying to get at with my idea of essence. What you thought in this neat formula, H2O. It's because water has that structure, it's because it's organized in that way, that it has all the other qualities. That's why it's transparent. That's why it's liquid at such and such a temperature range, and so on. The most important thing about a substance is that it exists on its own, in its own right, doesn't depend on anything else. That's the most important. But the second most important quality of a substance is that it is particular, that it is individual. The form of a particular substance is peculiar to that substance. Every form is a particular this, the form of this particular being. Every individual horse, every single one in the whole herd, in every herd throughout the whole planet, every particular rose is a distinct and different form. All that is the same about one rose and another rose is the fact that we happen to use the same word. Now that means that in Aristotle, form is not an abstract object that's separate from particulars, the way that Plato's ideas do. Any form is always the form of a particular thing, and it doesn't exist except in that particular thing. Form causes a thing to be what it is and to do what it characteristically does. But there's more to substance still than what it is. Things are getting stranger each moment. There's more to substance than what it is. There is, in addition, all that it can be, all that it could be, its whole range of potential. A given substance is a tree, but it could be a table, it could be a bridge, it could be material for a fire. Where does this potential come from? Aristotle's answer is matter. Aristotle lived a long time ago. We've gone a long way from Aristotle to the Higgs boson. Obviously, he doesn't think about matter exactly 100% the way we do, or even exactly 75% the way we do. The way he thinks of matter is that it's what is potential about a substance. Not what is actual, but what is potential. Matter, on his account, it isn't a stuff that bodies are made out of. It's a power of bodies to be modified. A body is material in the sense that it can be modified, you can change it, make the tree into a table. It can be shaped or reformed. To be material is to be like that, to have that kind of potential. Now, a substance that changes, any substance that can undergo a change, the tree changes color, changes height, the horse grows up, any substance that can change, it has to be composite. It has to be a combination of matter together with that form. A particular horse, a particular rose, an individual person, these are composite substances. They're composites of matter and form. Every movement, every change that a composite substance undergoes is a passage from potential to action. Think about that. A passage from potential to action. What could cause that kind of change? What could cause a mere potential to become action? Well, potential is just that. It's only potential. It's not actual. It has no actuality. And therefore, potentials cannot cause actuality. The only thing that can cause actuality, or that can actualize what's potential about substance, is another action. Potential, matter, it has no potency. All the potency, all the power, all the actuality is in the form, which Aristotle therefore calls the cause of all the change. Why did the tree that was green in spring become brown in autumn? What's the cause of that change? Aristotle's answer, the essence, the form, how it's been organized. The tree changes because of what a tree essentially is. because a tree has such an essence or form of organization that makes it lawful and necessary that it change according to the time. If you know that, if you know that law, that essence, that organization, then you will know all the rest. Now let me just touch on a couple of questions to bring this discussion of substance to a close, and then I'll pick up with this next one. Think about cells, living cells of an organism. Are those cells substances? Well, first we can think about, what about a single cell organism? A whole organism, a living, independent, autonomous organism, that's just one cell. In that case, the answer would be definitely yes. It's definitely a substance. First of all, I didn't know that there were such organisms, single cell organisms. But if he would have, he would have said, yeah, that's exactly what I mean by substance. What about cells in a body? The cells in your blood, the cells in your liver, the cells that make up your flesh. What about those cells? Are they substances? Now remember the definition of substance. What exists in itself and not in another. Is your hand a substance? Can it exist in itself or only in another? A hand, that's only a hand when it's part of a living body. That living body is the substance. Once the hand has been severed from the body, it's no longer a hand. It's just a piece of flesh. Then it's a substance. It's just so much earth, as Aristotle might say. But when the hand is part of the living organism, it's not a substance. It can't exist on its own. And the same would go for the cells that make up your blood or your liver. They have no being on their own, all by themselves. Only when they're in the whole organism do they have any kind of existence. So they're not substance. One last question. Aristotle talks about substance. He says that's the basic meaning of being. Plato talked about idea. He said to be is to be an idea. What's the difference exactly between these substances of Aristotle and those ideas of Plato? For Plato, the idea of a horse is different from every particular horse. There's all those particular horses, every one in the whole history of the planet. And then, over and above all those, separate from all those, there's the idea, of course. A separate entity, distinct, better, higher, more real. Aristotle rejects that picture of separation. Forms have no service, but Plato would, okay, there's been a lot of new terminology, a lot of difficult ideas. I'm going to have to stop there. We'll come back and continue this discussion after the Thanksgiving break. Thank you.